Welcome to Sweetland Center for Writing podcast series, Topics in Writing. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'll be speaking with David Jolliffe of University of Arkansas. Today we'll be talking about what we do with text, the role of reading, and analytical writing. But first, a brief bio. David Jolliffe is a professor of English, and by courtesy curriculum and instruction at the University of Arkansas, where he is the initial occupant of the Brown Chair in English Literacy. He earned a BA in English, magna cum laude, from Bethany College in 1974, an MA in English from West Virginia University in 1980, and a PhD in English from the University of Texas in 1984. A native of New Martinsville, West Virginia, Jolliffe began his career as an educator at Triadelphia High School and then at Wheeling Park High School, where he taught both English and theater. Jolliffe has also taught at West Virginia University, Bethany, and the University of Texas, the University of Illinois at Chicago, and DePaul University. He moved to Fayetteville in 2005 to inaugurate the work of the Brown Chair, whose mission is to promote critical and effective literacy among Arkansans in all walks of life. And welcome. Thanks for talking with the podcast series today. To start, what is deep reading, or what is the role of reading, the value of it in the analytical writing classroom?
Well, deeper reading, which is the title that Pat Sullivan gave to his book that I have the opening chapter in, I would characterize deeper reading as the kind of reading that asks students to go out on a limb and to posit for themselves what might be for them a major important idea, the major important idea in this piece that they're reading. What's the argument that the piece is making? But not only just to take a stab at the main idea. This isn't like, you know, the questions at the back of the chapter where you have to take a standardized test. This is really a more active, constructive move on the student's part where they're saying, I'm going to posit, let me argue that this is the most important idea or a central idea, but then let me also underline, point out, make clear that they know what's the evidence in the text that they would use to support that idea, that argument that this is the main idea. But even more importantly, what are the unspoken assumptions that exist in the forum that the text is written in? How is it that people think but don't necessarily speak their thoughts, that those assumptions, those ideas, those unspokens enable you to connect the evidence to the claim? So in other words, if you're reading, let's say I've just finished working with some folks, many of whom were anthropologists. If you're reading in anthropology and you'd say, okay, we've just read this article in anthropology, here's what I would posit is the main idea. Here's the evidence in the text that I would say supports that argument that this is the main idea, but here's how anthropologists think. Here's kind of some of the ways that they process the world that enables me as a budding anthropologist to connect that evidence to that text. So what I'm teaching in terms of deeper reading, I'm teaching just a little paradigm of claim, data, and I put data in scare quotes, and unspoken because. Okay, it's not always hard data. It's claim, data, unspoken because. I.A. Richards, the famous, you know, theorist of rhetoric, used to say rhetoric is the study of what's not on the page. And so what you're looking at there is you're looking at what are the unspokens that come into an argument that in order to really analyze what you see is as the argument, you need to be able to bring those unspokens to the level of spoken. Here's what people are thinking. Here's the way people think in this area. So that's what deeper reading is all about. Now, in addition, once you say, okay, my first job is to posit the argument and construct the argument and justify the argument, then you need to say, okay, now let's take a look at the parts of the text. How many parts are there? What is each part doing how do you justify each part as a part? And then what is each part doing to move the argument forward? I love doing this with the students. I'll say to them, take this article, and I want you to divide it into parts. Dr. Jolliffe, how many parts do you want it to have? I don't care. I don't care. How many parts do you want it to have? I
say what do you think it needs?
It has to have more than two. You have to have beginning, middle, and end. But, you know, I love to have students come in. They say, well, I say this has five parts. Okay, explain to me where your five parts and how you're going to justify each part as a part. I say it has seven parts. So you're right, too. So it's a matter of sort of giving students the ability to say, I'm processing this article, this chapter. Here's how I break it into parts, and here's what the parts are for me. Then I say, let's also take a look at the diction of it. Are there certain key terms that are shot through it that help you construct the argument? And finally, I say, let's take a look at at figurative language? Is there a central metaphor here? Is there something that sort of goes through the text that holds it together as a text? So it's really a matter of not just coming up with the main idea, but arguing, building an argument to support that this is your construction of the main idea, and then showing how the parts of the text support that idea construction.
So that's interesting, because it feels like it's all, as you're saying, it's all interconnected. There's like the deep reading component of it, mm-hmm. but it also sounds to me like so much of the work then is done in the classroom as a way to, in the writing classroom, to begin having them articulate the ideas
Correct.
Of what they're seeing.
Correct. It's a very hands-on tactic. It's you say, let's do this together. Let's get our hands into the text. My experience in these many years of teaching is that students frequently don't have a kind of a vocabulary to talk about the components and the texture of a text. So part of what I'm doing with teaching,
and we almost assume that they would somehow.
Yeah. But what part of what I want to do as a college reading and writing instructor is to give them some perspectives, give them some language that they can use to talk about the parts of a text, what's going on in the parts of a text. Here is this part of the text sets out a central idea. This part of the text offers potential contradictions to it. This part does the synthesis that brings the ideas together. This part brings out an exception. This part prepares us for the conclusion. This part does a conclusion. You know, you're really teaching them to gloss a text and to say, you know, what do you see the parts are doing?
Yeah, deconstruct it.
Sure, absolutely.
It also seems very important, and you've said it the word a couple of times, active.
Mm-hmm.
Like teaching students to be active within.
Yeah, I think that's so important for them. You know, I used to be a high school teacher, so I'm allowed to talk about high school teaching. But like a lot of times, students encounter two things in their high school courses. A, they encounter teachers who give them the readings. Here's the reading of this that I'm going to give you. Now you believe in this reading.
And like the key to it somehow.
Sure, sure. And so the students aren't really, they're not taught to do reading. They're given a reading. And I'm trying to militate against
that. A reading
that.
Of a reading.
Sure. And I'm also trying to help students not to give up too early. I think a lot of students will encounter a hard text. They'll get to something that the reading theorist Chris Tovani would call a stuck point, whatever that would be, and they give up, they stop. Or they get through a text and, you know, they put their eyes on the first word, they move their eyes over all the words. When they get the last word, they raise their eyes and say, oh, here's what I think this text is all about. But they've not done justice to the rich, full texture of the text that would enable them to come up with a more sophisticated, more complete construction of what a main idea would be. So I'm trying to do two things. I'm trying to, you know, help them say, you need to own this reading, and you need to work. You need to work at it. I always joke and say that...
And work it?
Work it. Yeah, you need to... You come to college to learn four-letter words? Work. Hard. Test. Pass. Fail. I mean, they're all four-letter words.
That's a good line.
Thank you.
That's a good one. So are you an advocate of then writing, like if you work it, like writing actually on the text itself, so printing out material? Or
yes.
So how are you finding the difference with so much of the reading on screens, or what do you do?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, you know, I'm enough of an old-fashioned Luddite that I still have something actually to keep, like reading journals and post things on the learning management system. So I'm still wanting them to, you know, I'm having a hard time figuring out how to then respond right on the text, whether it's if it's a virtual text. So my work is still, you know, you've read something on a screen, and now you want to post something on the Facebook or the Blackboard site or share things within a journal. Who was I? I was talking to one of the graduate students in English and Education today, who's actually doing a study of social media commentary commenting online with some folks, and I found it absolutely fascinating because I said, "Wow, I've never thought about that before. That's kind of new to me." So, in answer to your question, I'm not doing it.
Well, and writing is all around us, isn't it?
Sure.
As is reading. So how did you come to this, David?
Well, it's
an
interesting
path?
Question. I always had to, you know, have truth in advertising here. When I taught 21 years in Chicago before I came to Arkansas, and I really thought I would retire from DePaul University in Chicago. But I was sitting at my desk one day in 2004. And Arkansas called and I said, "We've got an endowed chair in literacy. Are you interested?" And I said, "Oh, tell me more."
The Brown Chair.
The Brown Chair, right. which is an interesting story in itself. And so I accepted the Brown Chair. And I began to reflect both on my own experience as a college writing teacher and on the water cooler. I call it the water cooler conversation you hear about reading. And, you know, T, you know this. Here's what you hear at the water cooler. Oh, students, they don't read anymore. Or they can't read. Or they don't want to read effectively. I think, you know, the three things I hear is they, you know, they don't read. My students don't read. Or they don't know how to read. Or, I think, kind of in a more subtle way, they know that they know how to read. They know they need to read, but they don't quite know how to incorporate their reading in their writing. They don't really see that relationship between their claims, their argument, and primary texts and secondary texts. So I thought, gee, maybe this is something that we ought to study in college writing. And I discovered, even before I moved to Arkansas, that there's very, very little scholarship on the role of reading in college writing instruction. Marguerite Helmer started it with a really wonderful book about 10 years ago, the name of which is escaping me right now. It's an edited collection. It's a green book. But then of course, Mike Bunn's work that came out of Michigan was very good work.
Ellen, How to Read Like a Writer.
Sure, sure. Ellen Carrillo's work at Pitt, that is now, Ellen's now at Connecticut. Mary Alina Salvatore and Pat Donahue, who have been editing a journal called The Reader for years, and they're very interested in reading. Linda Adler Kasner and Heidi Estrom have a piece on reading, but boy, you know, once you get to that, there's really not much else. Pat Sullivan and Howard Tinberg and Sheridan Blau have this book out called Deeper Reading, which they're trying to explain it. And of course, Alice Horning over at Oakland has been doing some work on reading as well. But if you compare the amount of scholarship on theorizing reading at the college level and theorizing writing at the college level, people have done a ton of work on writing, but it seems that reading has never really risen to the level of critical discourse in research the way writing has.
Because it's as if we're taking it for granted
I think there's a number of things come into play. First of all, the course called reading tends to drop out of the curriculum by eighth grade at the very latest. So there's an assumption when you get to be 12 years old, you know everything you need to know about reading. At the college level, when people hear the term reading, they assume remedial reading. They assume that this is sort of the developmental student. And I always want to say, no, let's talk about reading as a strategy that you get better at as you go along. I've been a singer my whole life, and I'm a better sight reader of music now at age 65 than I was at 45. So it's something that you get better at, and I think just continually you read more, you get better at reading.
It's a practice, just like writing.
Yeah.
We say this for writing.
Sure.
Just
like and anything, you know, and you know, if you have someone who's studying biology or physics, you know, as they get older, they get better scholarship in biology and physics. Similarly, you get better at reading as you go along. So that's part of what I've been doing, is trying to say this is something particular given the discourse of deficit that we hear. This is the water cooler conversation. We need to pay attention to this and say, what can we do as instructors to help our students become better readers?
And what can we do? Like, if we were going to give some...
Well, I would say there are really four things. First of all, you need to understand a little bit better about how good readers read. And the person whom I'm reading these days is a man named Daniel Willingham, who's a cognitive psychologist at Virginia. He had an op-ed piece in the New York Times about 2 months ago, which I had never heard of him before, but he's actually has new books out, the title of which is Escaping Me, which talks in very clear terms about what do good readers do when they read. So I think we need to pay attention to that. Second of all, I think we need to cue our students on what kind of reading we want them to do with the text. Linda Adler Kasner and Heidi Estrom talk about three kinds of reading. They talk about content-based reading, process-based reading, and structure-based reading. And their names are self-evident. So I think we want to say, when you read this, here's the kind of reading I want you to do. I'm trying my best these days to look over the syllabus I'm giving to students and say, when you read this piece, I want you to read this piece to take a look at how the author teases out this specific theoretical concept. When you read this piece, I want you to see, what does this writer do to exemplify ideas? So I'm really trying to cue students, you know, what do I want you to look at when you read? So it's not just put your eyes on the first word and lift them when you're done. Third, I think we need to give assignments that to call for what Ellen Carrillo calls mindful reading. We want students to, you know, when they're doing their assignments, we'd like them to reflect upon, okay, here's how I read to get this assignment done.
It's getting that I in there,
yeah.
As you mentioned earlier, yeah, the I in the process.
Correct. And then the fourth thing is, I think we as instructors need to be the best reader in our classes. We never need to hesitate to share with our students, here's how I read this. I like to teach the tactic, what I call an interrupted reading. You take the first paragraph of whatever you're asking students to read, and you stand in front of your class, and you read the first sentence aloud, and you say, okay, now here's what I'm thinking as I read this sentence. Then you read the first sentence and the second sentence aloud, and then you stop again. Here's how I'm constructing the idea. And then you do first sentence, second sentence, and third sentence. So you do this sequentially through the whole first paragraph. It takes 20 minutes or so, but it shows students, oh, that's the kind of connections we're supposed to make. That's how people think in this field. So you're really making your thinking visible to your students and being, we've always said, particularly in the outgrowth of the writing process movement, that, you know, a good writing teacher needs to write with her students. A good teacher needs to read with her students as well. I think there's nothing wrong with saying, you know, let me tell you what's on my nightstand. Here's what I'm reading. What are all of y'all reading, as I've learned to say in my 11 years in the South? You know, but that's the plural of y'all, by the all of y'all, the plural of y'all. So that's what I think we ought to do, just, you know, make it more mindful, make it more open.
And David, and what is your work with as the Brown Chair?
Oh, what's interesting, T, the Brown Chair has no specific direction in its originary language that said, I need to do anything.
Perfect.
Nice, yeah. But my first year I was in Arkansas, the dean gave me the year off from teaching. He says, I want you to get in your car, and I want you to drive around Arkansas, and I want you to discover where are the needs, what are the areas of the state that really need the most attention in terms of reading and writing. And the geography of Arkansas is very interesting. Where I live in northwest Arkansas, I can be in Missouri in an hour, in Oklahoma in an hour. I'm clear in the northwest corner. It's not that there are no problems there, but in some ways we live in the lap of luxury there. Population is growing, schools are great, unemployment is low, there's good music, good theater, good art. It's a great place to live, and more people are discovering it. You know, the bumper stickers are now, Fayetteville is a wonderful place, please don't move here,
right.
Because it's getting very crowded. But if you go east in the state, and you get east of Little Rock and a bit south, you come into a part of the state called the Arkansas Delta. And the Arkansas Delta is, as its name suggested, that part of the state where the watershed flows into the Mississippi River. It's the Mississippi River side of Arkansas side of Mississippi. And what has happened to the Delta is what has happened to rural communities many places. And the whammies that have hit, I call it the triple whammy. One is mechanization. It used to take 100 people to run a farm. Now it takes 4. One is globalization. It used to be that the cotton that got grown in the Arkansas Delta was sent to the textile mills in North Carolina. Now there are no textile mills in North Carolina. And the cotton that gets grown in Arkansas has to compete with cotton grown in Singapore and South America, et cetera. And then third, believe it or not, the interstate. The interstate comes whizzing past these small towns, pulls all the commerce from the small towns out by the interstate, and it tends not to be local commerce anymore. It tends to be big box franchise commerce. So that area that used to be the economic breadbasket of the state, there are counties in the Delta now that are losing 10% of their population every decade. And as a result, schools suffer, communities suffer. Whereas some people, I think, kind of would wish the Delta would sort of drop off and float down the Mississippi River, it's not going to do there. So I spent that first year in Arkansas realizing that if I wanted to do important work connecting literacy to community vitality, I needed to be working in the Arkansas Delta. So I started a project called the Arkansas Delta Oral History Project, where I'd work with 4 or 5 high schools a year and have these students in these high schools do oral history projects about some aspect of local legend or lore. That was a very successful project. Syracuse University published the book about it last year. That project has morphed into something new called SISTA, which stands for Students Involved in Sustaining Their Arkansas. What happens now in SISTA is that we recruit high school students and we say to them, if you would propose a project that in some way would revitalize or sustain your hometown or your home region, we'll hook you up with a one-on-one mentor from the University of Arkansas for a year. And you need to spend a year not doing the project, but doing research for the project and writing two substantial documents about it. Then when they get done it, they give it to me and I try to find funding for it. So largely, and that those are just two of the projects, largely what I've been doing is community literacy projects in these communities that sometimes involve students, but they may also just involve regular citizens in various walks of life who are saying to me, we understand the importance that critical reading and careful, forceful writing is going to play in our lives as we go forward. Help us do that better. So that's really what the Brown Chair has been doing.
Well, I'm so glad you've got it.
Thank you.
Because you're doing important work. And thank you for talking
with
the podcast series today, David.
Happy to. Thank you.
Today on the program, David Jolliffe with the Sweetland Center for Writing podcast series, Topics in Writing. Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks to Aaron Valdez, producer. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
You've been listening to the Sweetland podcast series, Topics in Writing, recorded at the University of Michigan. For more information about the Sweetland Center for Writing, visit us on the web at lsa.umich.edu/sweetland.